and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today that we're recording is May 26, 2023. And this is episode 380. Well, we're heading into Memorial Day weekend here in the U.S. anyway. Anyway, I'm the co-host, Mark Ames, up here in Western New York State. You are listening to Radio Warnerd at patreon.com/RadioWarnerd. And I'm on the line with the Warnerd, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in Puglia. And your superpowers are coming back thanks to the Peter Parker or whatever, you know, shot of B12, right?
They're coming back slowly. I mean, I've always dreaded that sign of aging, which is having to wait for the predicate of a sentence, having to wait for the key noun at the end of the sentence. And a lot of imitations of Biden, for example, exploit that. And it really is true. I used to be fluent, at least. I may not have been very wise or clever, but I was very fluent. I was nothing if not glib. And there was no pause or no discernible pause before the end of those sentences, but there is now. I don't know. Maybe if you write, it will increase the quality of your writing to have to pause.
Or you can smoke a whole bunch of pot when you're 8 years old and you have that problem starting at a very young age. I would not call myself fluent in that way, but
that went along with a lot of other things which I could have used. I don't know. Then there's the added problem of sometimes working in a second language. And I used to know Italian like a few months ago before this problem with oxygen in my blood developed. I spoke at least, you know, 2 out of 5 Italian. And I instantly went back to 0 out of 5. And I'm now slowly clawing my way back. Past, you know, 1 out of 5. And like today, there was this anecdote which everybody who's had to try to live in a language they don't speak very well, I think will kind of understand. Like, one thing about speaking another language that they don't always tell you is embrace the humiliation, to borrow your friend Bob's phrase. Yeah. Embrace the humiliation because you have to go through it. And like today's humiliation, we're in a new hotel. It's a strange place, nice place. We're the only guests because the weather is cloudy. And any cloudy weather sort of discourages Italians. It's like it's instantly the North Pole just because there's some cloud cover. So we're very much the center of attention being the only guests in this place. And it's a hotel on a fairly lonely road. And the owners are extremely nice to us, extremely kindly, like most Puglia people are. And some friend of the owner's walks in, waves to us, and brings up a teeny little dog in a dog coat because, you know, it's all of like 25 degrees or like 70 degrees Fahrenheit, and the dog might freeze.
Yeah.
We say hello to him and we say hello to the dog in wobbly Italian. And he says something that I think, because I'm crazy, is basho. And I think it means the haiku poet. And I thought, well, okay, I guess I'm never going to get away from these gnomic three-word Asian poets. So I say, oh, il poeta giapponese. And he looks kind of puzzled, and I was annoyed at that because, look, I want to say, like, sir, there's no oxygen in my blood. I'm trying to speak your language. And I thought, I thought it was broad-minded of me not to mind giving the dog a dumb minimalist haiku name, which reminds me of the terror of being a long-winded poet in you know, terse writing workshops circa 1980. So he puts the dog down and looked looks me over kind of weirdly. And then the dog glares at me and he goes away. And Catherine kindly explains to me that what he'd actually said was not basho, but lasho, which means literally I leave, as in I leave the dog here. Mm. I'm leaving the dog here. And by that time, you know, of course, all I could do was try to translate into Italian. Oh, I thought you said basho, not lasho, and I'm not actually insane. I figured that would just scare him even more. But it's one of those little humiliations that you can never fix, and you just have to go through it.
It suddenly occurs to me, like, if you had played that whole thing straight and took photos, like, trying to have crazy eyes in your photos, that this would have just been a bit like a classic sort of 1920s Dadaist or like Daniel Carms, you know, can I leave him here? Ah, Japanese poet, like you just said.
Yeah, now that would
people
been
would
cool.
be like, genius, genius.
Yeah. Then I could
That's
just
cut made,
somebody, somebody's eye out with a razor. I'd be triple genius.
Yes. This briefly just hit me, and I want to get it out before I forget about it, because you wrote about in an unpublished sort of follow-up that I've read parts of to your great comic memoir, Pleasant Hell. I remember this scene you were writing about making your first friends at Berkeley. Well, basically, mm-hmm. I want to tell you this story. You know, I've talked about this in the past a little bit. I don't want to dwell too much. This is, I guess, personal, but I have talked in the past about how my son, older son Sammy, had been bullied by his best friends in first grade. And it really, and the damage it caused. I mean, it's related to the war nerd. I've had some people appreciate talking about it because everybody has personal stories. A few people, I guess, who don't have those stories are thinking, like, why are you talking about it? Well, the nerd part in war nerd, bullying is a big part of that, you know, and I think it's why, yeah. and sort of finding other obsessions outside of the social world. But anyway, you know, Sammy's life has massively changed. My older boy's life has massively changed this year. He found a great friend. They hit it off, and he's now connected to the world again. And I saw this incident, it was like a week or two ago, that just reminded me so much of that moment you wrote about, where basically, so I let Sammy go and spend the afternoon, a Sunday afternoon, with his friend who lives, like, you know, two streets over. And somewhere in the middle of the day, I was home doing some work, and he came by with two other older kids who are neighbors of the friend. And they were covered in mud and clearly and just laughing. And, you know, they had this brother, he had to spray the mud off of them. And what were they going to do next? And so on. And then they eventually left. I helped clean them up some and they left. And that night, like, I could see on Sammy's face, he was still seven, so just before he turned eight, that he had literally had the best day of his entire life. He was with a gang.
Yeah.
The first time in his life, he was with a gang, you know, searching through a creek near our house, getting muddy, doing different things all the time outdoors. And it was like this feeling of belonging. I mean, I've seen the incredible, like, difference between, you know, 6 months earlier when he felt fully rejected first by his closest friends and then by the, to him, it was a sentence by the world on him. It
yeah,
was so devastating. Yeah. And it doesn't make you a better person, let me tell
no,
you.
No, it really no. doesn't. And I've seen a lot of contemptuous descriptions, contemptuous rejections of that feeling, but they tend to be written by people who don't have that kind of social problem.
Yeah.
And if you just naturally merge into a gang and you develop a contempt for that, that is great. That's like you're in the advanced class.
You made it, yeah.
Yeah. But if you're not, and you would love to be in a gang, which certainly I think maybe 60% of most kids do, and I certainly did, then you sort of drool about, you know, what in my time were images of gangs, I don't know, the banana splits or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah,
you know, hanging onto the back of a fire truck or something. Yeah. And there would be some goofy, almost Beverly Hills truck, Beverly Hills hillbillies truck that you could hang off the sides of or hang off the back of or hang on the roof of. And everybody'd have their place and everybody was goofy in their own way and nobody minded it. And that was the dream.
Yeah, I mean, he was so, that evening, he was so, he couldn't fully grasp the feelings that were going on inside of him, but he just, he said to me, like, I want to go back. It was early evening. Like, I don't want this day to end. And he was very sad. And, but in a good way sad, you know, very good way sad. And I just remember that bit from your memoir that you were working on, where you realize, I think you and Paul, and some others, like you were invited to go to Persian Burger on Dwight Way with them.
Yeah.
And then you said, it was at that moment you realized, I'm in a gang. Like, you know, resist.
Yeah. That was bliss. I mean, because I had, you know, friends or whatever before, but there was a lot of cruelty. And and this time I could just blend into the gang, and that was
a gang
wonderful.
You can trust, you know, which is not easy, and that you like being with rather than sort of by default.
And it doesn't make you feel that, the only reason they're with me is that they're losers too. I mean, that happens a lot with that state of mind.
Yeah, that's painful, and that's a good point. That's another story.
Yeah.
All right. So speaking of gangs, we're going to talk about another fun gang, Pancho Villa's gang, right? How's that for a segue?
They were probably pretty fun, too.
I know.
Scratching out a living as a sharecropper in northern Mexico.
I think in order, so maybe before we get to the raid, we should talk about sort of what's gone on in this crazy country.
Yeah, like why this matters. We're going to tell a story here. And that story is, as they say, very topical.
I mean, it's, you know, I have to admit, I kind of knew about this. But then when I went back and did the research again, it ain't no joke. I mean, so we're going to talk about the punitive expedition 1916 when Woodrow Wilson sent Pershing into Mexico after Pancho Villa. And it's a great story. And, you know, it should be a lesson. It obviously won't be. But the reason is that this year, it's kind of been building for a bit, but this year it went fully mainstream with the Republican Party. Invade Mexico, invade and bomb Mexico. They are hell-bent on it. It's literally every single presidential candidate, Trump, DeSantis, all of them are in favor of this. The top figures in the House and the Senate are in favor of it. So I think it's a pretty good bet that if DeSantis or Trump wins the presidency, and it is possible, I mean, Joe Biden's poll numbers, if it were any other, I mean, they're atrocious. And if it were any other time, it would be 100% for sure Biden's not going to win. These are weird times when everything polls badly and everybody's in a bad mood. So maybe it means that, maybe not. It's not like Biden is any great president himself. But at least he's not talking about bombing and invading Mexico. So, and so this whole sort of GOP madness about doing this sort of war on terror / drug war 2.0 in Mexico. It first kind of started in 2019 when Trump, it was when those Mormons, a bunch of Mormons were killed. It was 8 or 9 of them. American Mormons living in Mexico were killed by drug gangs. And Trump then asked his people to look at maybe declaring them terrorist organizations. And he kind of, he started really obsessing over it because as we all know, Trump hates Mexicans and hates, you know, so-called illegal, you know, migrants who come from south of the border. And that was really the cornerstone of his campaign in 2016.
Yeah.
And the next step to building a wall is bombing the other side of the wall and, you know, blaming all your problems on that. Apparently in 2020, Trump had asked his defense secretary, Mark Esper, if, quote, if we could just shoot some Patriot missiles and take out the labs, the fentanyl labs, quietly.
A strange choice of weapon, I know, isn't too. It? I mean, yeah. There are bigger surface-to-surface missiles in the U.S. inventory. You could just send an MLRS battery of missiles. They'll definitely take out the whole town it was in. But why? I mean, that's supposed to be a precision weapon. It was originally meant, as we've said it many times, to shoot down highly fragile fighter planes. It's dumb choice.
I really think at the top level in this country, anybody who is top level in sort of politics, national security, and basically, you know, with the other foot in the weapons profiteering industry, the Patriots have some kind of magic around them that I don't think any other weapon system has. And I think, you know, we didn't bring it up, I guess, in the last episode, but the Ukrainians were pushing for quite a while to get a Patriots to protect them. And they wound up getting a whole bunch of various air defense systems from all over the place. And they seem to generally work pretty well. But a Patriot is is like a show pony, or whatever. You know, it's a shit magnet because it's overrated and it's extremely expensive. And it's, you know, it was so obvious what was going to happen. So the Russians threw everything at the one or two Patriot systems they have. Their system, I guess, has a few batteries in it. And although there's so much propaganda around it right now, you know, all you can do is take your best guess based on the fallout from it. But it seems pretty clear that either the Russians hit it or the way that they flooded the system caused it to hit them itself. Something bad happened. That was like the worst marketing event ever for the Patriot. And they've just, if you ask me, they've moved it somewhere totally secure, way off base, like everything turned off, covered in concrete. This baby is worth billions of dollars. Fuck you, everybody. We're protecting this billion-dollar baby, you know?
Well, even the Israelis, the first time it was used, you know, initially they were grateful that it was sent to them in the first Gulf War as a gesture from the U.S. And then they quietly grumbled, you know, this thing doesn't work against Scuds. and to be fair to the Patriot, it wasn't meant to bring down Scuds. A Scud is an unguided missile. It's a gigantic tub of explosives that's just lobbed toward your territory. And it doesn't necessarily, some models do, but it doesn't necessarily have any guidance at all. And this little thing that was meant to explode and send fragments into the highly delicate little navigational surfaces of a fighter plane, of course it doesn't affect that. It's like firing a BB at a rock, a big rock, like the chunk of concrete to get back into childhood trauma that Kenny Tamplin dropped on my head. Like a BB wouldn't have made any difference to that.
Yeah, but, you know, as Berezovsky famously said to General Lebed about don't end the Chechen War back in 96, Sasha, it's a Haroshi business. It's a great business, you know. And the Patriot is, and all that anti-air missile stuff. Big business.
Yeah.
So anyway, you know, back to the story at hand, this is going to be a major plank in, as we get closer to 2024, which is, are you for, you know, protecting Americans, which would mean invading Mexico or bombing Mexico? Or actually what they're proposing is this, what the Republicans are proposing, Trump, all of them, is first of all, declaring the drug quote unquote cartels, which are really drug gangs, but we call them cartels, that we designate them as foreign terrorists. As you know, you know, when the U.S. government designates something, some block of things, you know, foreign terrorist, that kicks in a whole lot of other stuff and laws and, you know, ups the penalties for anybody associated with that and authorizes a lot of military and assassination campaigns. I mean, it really does ramp it up to a different level. And so Trump was going to do that in 2019. And the Mexican president basically said, this is going to be a violation of our sovereignty and we'll crack down on them. You know, we'll take care of this. And miraculously, you know, Trump talks a lot of talk and sometimes mm-hmm. he walks that walk and sometimes he's like weirdly, I don't know if it's because people told him to back down or if it's just these weird ticks in his head, but he did the same thing, which is he said, okay, you know, you're right. And Mexico should handle this.
Well, I think maybe, I mean, he seems pretty straightforwardly wired. Like, he says something that will thrill the base. They get thrilled. Okay, transaction over. I mean, why do anything else that's dangerous and might make you unpopular?
Right. But he kind of let the cat out of the bag. And since then, you know, all the other Republicans, including those who don't like Trump at all, which is, you know, let's be still most of them, they still look to him for new ideas because they think, and it, you know, it's kind of true compared to them. I mean, their big ideas, you know, what do the people want? Lower taxes on the rich and free markets. Well, it's not. They look to him for ideas. And then he just farts something out of his head and they think it's brilliant and they run with it, you know? Mm-hmm. That's pretty much the GOP these days. Yeah. So, but there's a horrible logic to it as well. I mean, the fentanyl overdose epidemic in the U.S. is insane. I mean, I think it was last year, 71,000 people died of it. It's crazy.
Yeah, you know? To be crude, when you have a lot of friends who are dying, that's when, you know, it gets real. And I think most of us have had that.
Yeah.
And in that way, it does sound like a terrifying drug, like out of the drug scare wars. But the strangest thing is that a lot of otherwise sane people apparently believe that the fentanyl is either snuck into the U.S. by Mexicans or just sneaks itself over and then mugs people in alleys and injects itself into them. I mean, people want it. People want to have a nice night of just, well, what turns out to be oblivion, but is marketed as bliss.
Well, a lot of it, though, is basically mixed in with other drugs. So I was looking up some of this, like, for example, meth now, which, you know, for all of meth's many dangers, it's meth is usually a danger over time. I mean, it just, you know, it breaks you down. It makes you feel like Superman for a while. And then if you can't kick it, your body starts to fall apart. But deaths from meth, I was very surprised to read this, have gone from like, I don't know, 1,000 a year, which even that seems kind of high, but I can believe it, to, you know, like 10, 15,000, something insane. And it's because fentanyl gets stepped on with fentanyl, mixed in with fentanyl. Same with
cocaine.
That's
bizarre. I admit I'm a pretty naive drug consumer, or was one when I could.
Yeah, I'm a dinosaur compared to today's drugs. Yeah.
But how would you mix meth with fentanyl?
It's a white powder. And it's apparently being so mass produced. It's
cheap.
Yeah,
but so is vitamin B. If you want to have a meth effect, it's the opposite of a fentanyl effect. I don't get it.
Maybe, well, meth apparently is also much stronger now than even just 10 years ago. I guess they're going for kind of a speedball effect. And a lot of people are, speaking of speedball, are also dying, thinking they're snorting cocaine, but it's coke mixed with fentanyl and they're doing too much of it. It's usually just people not quite, it's a lot harder to kind of measure the right dose with fentanyl. Yeah. Didn't Philip Seymour Hoffman, I think, die of fentanyl?
Yeah. I'm gonna say. Well, yeah. I think he died. He might have died.
Oh, he was speedballing, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he was rich enough that he would get fairly informed.
That's true.
Marketing.
A lot of the fentanyl problem started, as I understand it, because, look, for 20 years, the pharma companies were pouring synthetic opioids into all over the country and making it really easy to get them. And I know you've complained, since you've had some bad injuries, you couldn't get, you know, a Vicodin if your life depended on it. And that's that's because of the backlash, which, you know, this country always goes too far and then other countries take the lead. The backlash against the overprescribing, and it really was. I mean, they very openly targeted. I mean, there was like a opium war, you know, let's get everybody hooked on this drug. And the Sackler family and others made billions off of it. And so when the U.S. really cracked down, they went through a couple of crackdown periods, I think under Obama and then really under Trump, it's now almost impossible to get. I mean, you have to have your guts hanging out of your body to get like a half a Vicodin now. And you left all these people who have, you know, real chronic pain or just junkies or whatever, like with nowhere to turn. And fentanyl is filled that void in a huge way.
Right.
And so another thing that makes it popular among the Republicans is that fentanyl is supposedly produced in China, or a lot of it is produced in China. Then it's shipped to Mexico, where it's refined and, you know, distributed through Mexican drug cartels. And this whole thing, this word cartel, I was listening to this really good episode of TruAnon recently, and they had on this guy, Osvaldo Zavala, who wrote a book, Drug Cartels Do Not Exist. And he makes this, you know, a great obvious point, which is, why do we call them cartels? I mean, I think that name came from the 80s. It was marketing people, as always, Reagan's marketing people, to make them sound bigger and more serious and worse than they were. I think this is shortly when everybody was still traumatized in the U.S. by the idea of the OPEC cartel, or, you know, cartels are bad and giant.
Yeah.
Giant.
And I guess it's another way of not saying corporation, which
exactly,
business, which is a sacred word, even though it certainly has some similarities with the drug
very
cartel.
Much. But a cartel, it doesn't. You can't. If it was a cartel, they wouldn't be killing each other. If it was, if these were cartels, it would just be one, or they would all be working with each other rather than constantly fighting each other. And, you know, it's obviously not a cartel. It's very much a free market enterprise, you know, with competition.
Hardcore libertarianism.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so it's better just to call them drug gangs, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
So you have the hatred of China, blame it on China.
How come Russia's not in there? You got to get Russia in there.
Well, but the GOP, remember the GOP?
Because
Putin hated Hillary, so therefore they think Putin embodies, like, you know, white conservative values and this crap. And they just aren't down with it. Well, a lot of them are, but a lot of them aren't as well. The base is not with them on that. And also the hatred, you know, Mexico's president, AMLO, as he's known, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who is a leftist and a left populist. So there are a lot of reasons for these Republican politicians to hate, to sort of focus on, let's bring a war to Mexico. You're going after a lot of things. You're going after drugs, Mexicans. You know, they talk about, we'll build the wall and then bomb them and then send in the military to the other side of the wall. I mean, it's so nuts. Here's what Tim Scott said. He just announced his presidency, and he had, I can't remember the name, was it John Thune, or one of the big, I think the number two Republican in the Senate has already endorsed him. He said, when I'm president, the drug cartels using Chinese labs and Mexican factories to kill Americans will cease to exist. I will freeze their assets. I will build the wall, and I will allow the world's greatest military to fight these terrorists, because that's exactly what they are. So everybody's going Trumpy, you know, in this way.
It's strange. I mean, I don't. It's as if people enjoyed Breaking Bad for a while, and they realized, yeah, you can make meth in a recreational vehicle, okay? And then they sort of thought, no, it has to be made somewhere in some alien evil country.
So you have some, pseudo-populists like that rich private equity guy, J.D. Vance, or, you know, Marjorie Taylor, whatever the fuck her name
Green.
Is. Green, yeah.
Remember names
I know,
again.
Huh? MTG, yeah, saying, you know, why is Biden giving money to Ukraine but not bombing Mexico? You know, it's sort of like leave it there. Oh, Japanese poetry. It's a total non sequitur there. Okay. You know,
but, oh, God, I'll be talking like that soon. Just shoot me.
I love that one. So, crazy as it is, they want, first of all, a lot of these people are citing the Plan Colombia. Is that what it was called? Mm-hmm. Basically, the U.S. Plan Colombia started, right. I think, under Clinton and then really picked up under Bush and lasted a couple decades where the U.S. Helped Colombia's right-wing governments fight the left-wing rebels under the guise of fighting drug cultivation, which was helping like the FARC and some of the other rebel movements.
Yeah, they financed themselves. Like the way they saw it, why shouldn't we finance the revolution by helping these rich people to shove this poison up their noses? Yeah. Fine.
And the end result of it was, obviously the country screwed up, but the end, it's considered a success, I guess, by these Republicans. But as I understand it, looking up some of the stats, I mean, drug cultivation has actually grown since 2000, like the amount of land cultivated, just moved to different people or elements of the FARC. They just sort of thought, you know what, drug sales is better than left-wing politics. I'm going to stick with this. So the drug part didn't work as well, but eventually, you know, there was a peace deal and that worked better. In fact, they have a former rebel who's now president of Colombia. But that's a political solution, you know. Other Republicans are actually tabling a new law in OMF, authorization for the use of military force, which should be like a dirty word in politics, because the AUMF, the AUMF, is what Bush got after 9/11 that, you know, launched the war on terror, which led to, the Iraq war, which, as a recent study out of Brown University just came out and said, that war has killed 4.5 million people. It threw 7.6 million children into malnutrition, tens of millions displaced. Like, that's what we want. That's what we want to emulate is that plus the war on drugs.
I mean, the parallel to the story we're going to be telling is extraordinary because more than 100 years ago, the chiefs of staff of the U.S. Army, effectively the same rank, said to a presidential representative, are you telling me we're going into another country, a sovereign state, after one person? And, you know, the echoes of bin Laden were unmistakable.
Yeah, yeah. In a sense, they were saved from that debacle by, hey, we've got an even dumber war to get to.
Yep.
You know, let's
bigger,
go fight
dumber.
Europe.
Yeah. Yeah.
And faster death. So anyway, so that's sort of the background to this. The momentum's going with the Republicans, with the Trumpists, you know, normies would say, come on, that can't possibly happen. And then it does happen. And it
will
probably
happen again.
Will.
Yeah. I mean, I admit I have confused feelings when I think, but these people have lived through, well, basically decades of projects like this, and they've all failed. Doesn't that mean anything? And no, I mean, I remember a story that you told long ago about, I think, a roommate you had in Texas who would brag about how he put himself through college selling drugs, and then would, a few hours later, watch a story about drug dealers on TV and say, they ought to just shoot all those guys.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, he was completely supporting Bush Sr., the world's biggest drug dealer at the time through the CIA, his war on drugs. And I was, and this guy was a physics grad student and selling weed still. And I just saw absolutely no contradiction there whatsoever. And, you know.
That scared me. Yeah, that's why I remembered that story.
Well, yeah, I packed everything up in my car and split Texas shortly after that. You folks is crazy.
You could have dropped a dime on him, too, just for,
yeah, I know.
For auld lang syne.
So let's get to this to the story of Pancho Villa.
All right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there is, as we say, a precedent for this. And we've talked about it a few times on Radio Warnerd, and I've written on it long before there was a Radio Warnerd, just in character as the Warnerd. And it's an extraordinary story. A lot of times, I know as a, you know, violence-starved kid, that is violence that was not directed at me. I often thought, yeah, this landscape is stupid. There's no battles all around here. But there were. There were a lot of battles in a lot of parts of the U.S. that you don't expect. And there, one of the most dramatic, if not the biggest battles, was in 1915 on the southern border, which was a raid by Pancho Villa on Columbus, New Mexico. Pancho Villa is an extraordinary character. He was extraordinary at the time. He's vividly remembered. You just have to look at one photograph of him and his image is in your mind forever. The camera, as they say, loved him. But he came from nowhere. He was born... when you see his real name, you can see why he became Pancho Villa. His real name was Jose Doroteo Arango Arambula, and he changed that wisely to Pancho Villa. Born around 1878 to a poor family in Chihuahua, northern Mexico, became a really poor sharecropper, miserable existence. Moved to Chihuahua, also in northern Mexico, and then became a bandit. His version of that story of why I became a bandit is very plausible, may be true, but it also happens to be every bandit story of why I became a bandit. And it was, I came back to my home in Durango to kill this rich hacienda owner who raped my sister, and then after that I had to go bandit. Very possibly true, very possibly not true. Mm-hmm. But this was, you know, around the middle of the second decade of the 20th century, and I just thought I'd do a quick scan of what was going on elsewhere, because as Yeats said rather memorably for the people who died in the Easter Rising, they were going to die in World War I anyway. That whole demographic was going to die.
Right.
And they said they were going to sell their lives at a better market. So in April 1915, where this battle on the southern border of the U.S. climaxed, what was going on? At the end of March, the longest siege in Europe in the First World War ended with the crushing of the Austro-Hungarian army by the Russian army, which involved 135,000 Austrian casualties and probably higher Russian casualties, because the Russian army did not particularly care about its soldiers, and they usually managed to get them killed even in victories. On 22nd April of that year, Second Battle of Ypres, first gas attack by the Germans, 70,000 Allied casualties, 35,000 German casualties. And maybe biggest of all, 25th of April, 1916, Anzacs landed at Anzac Cove to begin the invasion of the Gallipoli Peninsula in Turkey. About a year later, they left after suffering 200,000 casualties for one of Churchill's written on a luncheon mat ideas while he was half drunk. May 7th, the liner Lusitania was sunk by a German U-boat, a modest loss of 1,200 civilians, and provoking the U.S. to push closer to its engagement in the big war.
You know, it was over the Lusitania and the note that Wilson demanded that his Secretary of State send to Germany, basically telling them that, you know, your whole submarine policy is an affront to humanity. It was a very bellicose letter that they had to stop it. And his Secretary of State at the time was William Jennings Bryan, the famous populist, right, and Democratic. He became sort of the leader of the populists after their own party kind of imploded in the late 1800s. And he was anti-war, as the populists were, anti-empire and anti-war. And when he saw the note, he said, because William Jennings Bryan's policy was strict neutrality. So if we're going to say something to the Germans like this, then we have to also send another note that goes to the British to say, you know, watch what you're doing on the seas as well. Something that would balance it out rather than clearly picking a side. And Wilson said, absolutely no. So he resigned. And that's when he resigned, and a new Secretary of State came in that said basically we knew we were going to eventually enter the war.
Well, you know, this is becoming a theme of the show. Well, I think for a lot of other historians, contemporary historians, there's no limit to Wilson's disastrousness. I mean, it's extraordinary. From segregation to foreign policy, he was what a mess for. For somebody who didn't talk sloppily or look like a mess the way somebody, say, like Trump does, he was for somebody who was caricatured, like by the woman who narrates True Grit, as the finest Presbyterian gentleman of the age. He was a pretty horrible person, total disaster. So Villa moved south, originally recruiting about 400 other sharecropper kids, and joined in the wars of the Mexican Revolution. And part of the reason that he became very famous and worshipped to the point that you could see his poster along with Zapata's in many dorm rooms when I was a student, is that John Reed, the famous revolutionary journalist, accompanied him. He was kind of embedded. It was kind of weird, like a less talented Isaac Babel. Isaac Babel accompanied the Red Cavalry and wrote a magnificent book about him, about them. John Reed accompanied Villa and spent 4 months embedded with his army, and wrote a lot of very romantic stuff about it.
I'm sorry, I have to ask. Whenever I think of John Reed, and it's ruined for me, I might have otherwise had a different impression, I just think of
Warren Beatty.
Yeah, Warren Beatty's face looking looking like I'm kind of bewildered like a puppy, but look how sexy I am also.
Yeah.
While I'm, I don't know, reddening the earth or something. I don't know what the hell he's doing. Like, what did you, first of all, did you ever see Reds or have you read any of his books? 10 days.
No, I didn't see Red because there is a limit even to my self-destructiveness. I haven't read any of his books. He seems a little naive, and those guys never make you feel any better.
No, exactly. I was just curious.
So yeah, even Woodrow Wilson, after Reed got done with the rehab on Villa, said that Villa was, quote, a sort of Robin Hood who had spent an eventful life robbing the rich in order to give to the poor. He had even at some point kept a butcher shop for the purpose of distributing to the poor the proceeds of his innumerable cattle raids. And that's Wilson, who was a horrifically reactionary figure in most ways. But, okay, there's a lot to cover here, so just... And we're talking about swirling cavalry battles, mostly irregular cavalry. No way to cover it in time. But let's just focus on the Battle of Celaya, which was the moment that Villa's units, the Division of the North, which at one time had 40,000 men, artillery, a train, doctors, everything... this massive core-sized force was
broken. Isn't that just incredible? I got to say that, first of all, just that he was able in that period to raise such a core, of that level.
Yeah, and it's pretty well organized too. Yeah. I mean, the problems with them were command problems. Like basically, he had no sense of how to fight a prepared position. And that's what happened at Celaya.
Right. The things that worked for him as he was, when he was smaller, building his way up, suddenly were the things that wouldn't work for him when he had a core to do.
Funny thing is, Warren Zevon has songs about the Mexican Revolution. Veracruz is Dying, for example. And there's a line of his that applies very much to Villa at Celaya. He said, the things that used to work, well, they won't work now. that was Villa at Celaya. So this is the El Bajío is a lowland area to the west of the plateau where Mexico City is. And Celaya is there. There's lots of silver towns around there. It's a very big area, but Celaya was where Obregón, which was – his name was originally O'Brien, and the family changed it to Obregón.
Wow.
He almost looks like Kitchener in some photos. Very unlike the flamboyant Pancho Villa. He has that sort of button-down appearance, and they fought – somewhat according to their looks. So Villa was sweeping south. He originally started with like 375 poor farmers. Then he met Obregón's army, which was the official army of the Mexican state, on April 6th and 7th. And it was a disaster. Basically, Obregón listened to people, and he realized that the implication of everything he heard from the Western Front, and he had German advisors with him on the battlefield, was that defense, overlapping fields of fire, barbed wire, and machine guns could defeat any cavalry attack. In fact, most other armies just didn't do cavalry attacks anymore. So he fortified the town of Celaya, dug trenches against cavalry. His German officer advisors supervised the fields of fire for machine guns. He used a hell of a lot of barbed wire. Villa, on the other hand, figured this was the same as attacking a village in Chihuahua. Mm. That is basically everybody charges. And I mean everybody. One of the factors in the Battle of Celaya is that there was no reserve on Villa's side. So even when he saw a weakness, there was no darn thing he could do about it. So Celaya was basically a slaughter. 6,000 of Villa's core troopers, including many of the Dorados, the golden ones, his core troops, right, were just slaughtered and died stupidly, charging barbed wire and trenches on horseback. You can't do that. I mean, it's just never going to work. And he said famously, when they were threatened with running out of ammunition as well, he said, morale will be our ammunition. God. And that's when you run. That's when you go for the nearest gully and you run far away. Because even if they shoot you in the back. So Villa was crushed. I mean, his army was crushed. And people started to realize, this guy doesn't know a thing. He may be good at surrounding villages, but he's not any good with prepared positions. He was down to 2,000 men from 40,000. They rode north. Then he gets an idea. And Villa was superb at public relations, like many guerrilla commanders are. He realized that the United States was becoming intensely unpopular for very good reason in Mexico. He didn't start out particularly anti-American. I mean, he was fairly flexible about such things. But after Celaya, there was a great deal of anti-Americanism in Mexico. The United States had chosen, with a typical stiff-necked, obnoxious Woodrow Wilson move, to occupy the Veracruz on the eastern coast for 7 months, which poisoned the reputation of the United States forever in Mexico. It's another very complicated story, but the U.S. and Mexico squabbled about debts, and then they squabbled about whether Mexico was required to give a 21-gun salute to the U.S., and they said, no, only if you give us a 21-gun salute, and blah, blah, and
Wilson got enraged. Give them a 21-gun salute? Yeah. Why, that's war.
And Mexico distributed rifles to the population of the city, and there was a lot of firing from a half-ruined city, which means a lot of heavy casualties for everybody. First he said, very, very typical. I mean, very, very American pattern. First, he wanted to expel him through moral force. That was his term. And then God, if moral force doesn't work, send in the Marines.
God, that is so typical, isn't it?
Yes. And the Marines in this era, it was a pretty nasty era in a lot of countries, yes, but particularly in the U.S., they were very cruel people.
We covered this in our episode with Jonathan Katz on Smedley Butler, and Smedley Butler wrote about it. I mean, it drove him crazy after a while. He was an instrument of this period. Really nasty imperialism. Yeah.
Yep. So Villa is facing disaster. I mean, PR is his job as a guerrilla commander. He has to recruit people. He's down to 2,000 from 40,000. Who's unpopular, and quite rightly? The United States. He's moving north back to his home territory in Chihuahua, and he's trying to figure out a strategy that will work for him and form new armies. And he thinks, I'll raid the U.S., the soft underbelly of the U.S. But a lot of other people have that idea too, because there is a lot of righteous rage in Mexico about the United States. And what I had only recently learned here is that Villa's raids were not unique at all. I mean,
yeah, that was surprising, huh?
Yeah, even the right-wing government of Mexico funded people it called seditionists, and their mission was officially to raid U.S. assets and start a war because they figured, what the hell? We lost half our country in 1848. Let's roll the dice. These people have no respect for us anyway. Let's see what happens. So in 1 year, 1915 to 1916, there were 38 armed incursions from Mexico into the U.S., and that yielded 26 U.S. soldiers killed. Now, that's pretty remarkable. So at Ojo de Agua, which
Eye
I think just
means... Eye of the
water? Yeah, it just means sort of a watering hole. Across from Reynosa, Mexico, there was a big skirmish between seditionists and U.S. forces. It scared the Mexican regime a little bit, so Carranza canceled further seditionist rage. But people were doing it freelance. There was real anger. And basically, Villa wants to get in on this. He was a real nationalist. He thought of himself as a Mexican patriot, but he also had a canny PR mind. And he's also good at disinformation. So if we can use that word. So first he spreads the word that he's going to Washington to talk with Wilson, which is kind of droll in a very Villa way. And it also is a misdirection play. His real target, he's decided after scouting some other places, is Columbus, New Mexico, just across the border from Palomas in Mexico. It's about 100 miles west of Las Cruces, New Mexico. Most of all, he needs supplies. He needs to humiliate the U.S. at a weak point and equip new recruits so that the Division of the North can be as powerful as it once was, and he can be one of the players again.
Part of the goal is to goad the U.S. into chasing him into Mexico, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a bit of a Bin Laden strategy, although it didn't work as well for Villa. In a sense,
yeah.
Bin Laden's worked out, in some ways better.
Yep. Yeah, chase me into Iraq where I'm not.
Exactly. But, yeah.
Okay. There is tremendous outrage in the U.S. The U.S. is getting ready parts of the U.S. population are getting ready to intervene in the war in Europe for no sane reason. Basically, the old umbilical to Britain. Those who are not in with that plan or being, as Adam Hochschild has written in that book, American Midnight, are being hung up by their thumbs to prison walls. Everybody's kind of excited about this. Oh boy, this is again a very, probably universal, but I can attest, a very American reaction, like, oh boy, somebody provoked us. Hunter Thompson said long ago about the Hell's Angels when he was riding with them that they said they never started a fight, but they managed to be provoked on a regular basis.
And that's kind of to their credit, right? So that because they, a lot of Americans more deeply believe it. I always remember one of the first sort of bar fights I saw after I moved to Moscow in like 93, it was like 93, 94, between an American expat and a Russian guy. And I just came there when I heard the yelling, and it sounded very familiar sort of yelling. And I sort of come around the corner and there's a little crowd sort of around, it's nighttime. And there's this American guy who's already ripped off his shirt It's like, come on, man. Come on. Yeah, come on, man. You hit me. I dare you. You got to hit me. Hit me. And the Russian's just kind of looking at him with kind of half asleep eyes, kind of just like, yeah, what is this guy doing? And finally, the Russian guy just goes, boom, pops him in the face. Like, he was falling down. Like, oh, man. And then the fight was pretty much over at that point already.
Yeah.
It was just like,
I saw a pro fight, like an MMA fight between this American who was incredibly buffed and like high on his own macho before the fight. He was like tensing and screaming, and the Russian guy looked like a sack of proverbial shit. And he was just sort of slouching over, you know, like a tired ogre in his corner. And the American guy, he was real, at least, you know, he zoomed into the middle of the ring and knocked the Russian guy down, and the Russian guy kind of blinks and goes, oh, okay. You got to start trouble, huh? And like 1 minute later, the American was on the ground. It was classic. But anyway, so the raid actually began. I'm zooming through this story because it's we got a lot to cover here. March 9th, 1916, Villa had scouted Columbus, New Mexico, small town, big barracks, bigger than his scouts told him. And they, two columns of cavalry spread out over the town. It's on flat desert. One attacks the barracks. The other starts burning and looting the town. They burn every store that doesn't sell the supplies they need, because one of the reasons for this raid, in classic irregular cavalry tradition, is to get the stuff. They also try to break into the bank and loot it as you would, but they don't manage to do that. It's too fortified.
I saw that photo of the bank vault, which is still like a monument, right? It's still sort of just sitting there in the middle of scrubland. It's kind of a cool monument, I have to say.
I know. It's just like a big armored column. And it has money in it. Or at least it used to.
Yeah.
The U.S. forces behave pretty well. They, they start fighting back. They start retaking the town, fighting in small units. And it's pretty soon a crossfire in the dark between pockets of U.S. troops and pockets of Villistas. And at dawn, Villa's forces withdraw. The bugle blows, and they're fairly orderly. They withdraw at that sound. They take 300 rifles, 100 horses, food, money, and clothes. But they've lost a lot of people. One account said, quote, dead Villistas were lying in the streets. Many were mere boys, 14 to 17 years old. Because Villa, like a lot of guerrillas, did his recruiting at gunpoint. There's one account of a guy who was recruited at 14. And then his uncle was a lieutenant of Villa's and said, You can't recruit my little cousin here. And the little cousin said, no, I want to stay. I want to be part of the raid. And it reminded me of what Lucky Ned Pepper said in True Grit, like, oh, he was game. All boys is game, but a man will look out for himself. This is after he's just gotten this kid killed in his own service.
There's a Netflix movie, was it Beasts of No Nation, about child soldiers?
Oh, yeah.
It was pretty good, too, in Africa. Yeah, it was good. Anyway.
Yeah, because they make you part of the family.
Yes, and, yes.
Well, first they kill your family, and then they make you part of a new family. So, you know, it's one-stop shopping, the whole thing. So the U.S. casualties are about 18, 8 soldiers, 10 civilians. But the Villistas, out of a force of maybe 600, they lose about 150. And their bodies are burned. There's not a lot of respect here. This is not chivalrous warfare. This is a cause for outrage. And of course, there's endless yellow journalist calls for revenge. Mm-hmm. And of course, Wilson is all for that. He wants to go into Mexico, and he wants the government of Mexico's permission, but Carranza refuses. So the U.S. Army Chief of Staff asks Wilson, Secretary of War, you know, and this is the kind of question that should have been asked about 20 years ago, but I don't think it was. Suppose Villa gets on a train and goes to Guatemala. Are we going to go after him? And the guy says, well, no. You want his band captured then? Yes. Okay. So March 1916, the U.S. wants an excuse to have a little practice war anyway. And John J. Pershing, who was renowned supposedly for his diplomatic skills, although they weren't too much in evidence in Europe later.
His massacring, right? I mean, he was in the Philippines counterinsurgency and also a friend of the show, Hunter Polly, a journalist out in Montana, reminds Pershing played a central role in the Montana Cree deportation, where they were ethnically cleansed from there. So he has a lot of valuable experience, I guess, in some nefarious.
Well, I suppose you use diplomacy with people who are powerful enough to force you to. And to be fair, that's not just an American habit. So Pershing leads this overwhelming force in March 1916. Two cavalry brigades, an infantry brigade, total of 10,000 men in what is called a punitive expedition into Mexico. Chihuahua and north central Mexico. Carranza says, no, you may not use our railroads to invade our territory, which shocks Wilson and company. So the army has to use trucks, a whole convoy of trucks. But they're kind of okay with that because they're really gearing up for what they hope is going to happen in Europe soon.
Yeah.
It's classic funding increase stuff.
Right. George Patton comes along with Pershing, and I just seem to remember ages ago I read some biography on him, and he just was so excited, like, good, I'm going to get some real world, you know, training in for the
we'll
big
get
war.
To him in a bit. He got his trophies, and I use the term advisedly. Carranza allows the expedition to enter Mexico, not to use the trains, but to enter Mexico at first, which makes him very unpopular. And he soon reverses that decision because there is to be explicit, a bit of trouble. So it's a very rough country. The trucks have to be tinkered with, a lot of canyons, extreme weather, especially as you change altitude.
Not much in the way of roads either.
Not
for cars.
Much, no. Yeah. And that's why they thought air recon would be the big new thing. But that didn't work really either. It probably did help them in a real defense industry way, in that some problems showed up in this rehearsal, basically, that could be fixed by the time they went into Europe. But basically, the planes crash or clogged with dust, they can't be used. It's a very new technology, and it hasn't really been adapted to adverse circumstances. But basically, the tech is pretty good. The trucks are pretty good. The planes are pretty good. But so what? What they're finding, and they don't quite know it yet, is that guerrilla war isn't like that. You don't live by tech. I mean, I grew up with every single issue of Popular Mechanics boasting some new technological trick that was going to fix Vietnam.
Yep.
And none of them did, and took an awful long time for people like Westmoreland to get the point.
Yeah, well, I mean, we see this happening even with Ukraine. There's always going to be some technological fix. It was the HIMARS was going to change everything. And, it, you know, it affected things for a while, but only for a month or two. I think it really provided a big advantage that it was HIMARS, then it was, I don't know, the Leopard tank, and then it was the Patriot, and we saw it now. Yeah. And now it's going to be the F-16. So, I think we've seen this, in war after war, and a guerrilla war especially. Yeah. It's not going to work. I mean, in a more conventional war, it's going to have more effect. But yeah.
Yep. Yep. It didn't. But there, it worked in the sense that defense tech does work. That is, it worked for funding, and it worked on the domestic U.S. audience. Like I viewed some contemporary movies. It was a little before talkies. And by the way, one of the things I was amazed by is they left those little subtitles up for a really long time. A lot of the audience, I think, was spelling every word out. But there's one about the Mexican expedition, and it's all gung-ho. And the subtitle is about assembling 3-inch guns, mountain guns. And then it says, the entire mountain artillery force of the U.S. consists of only 12 3-inch guns. Consider our meager force of 12 pieces. God. Then the fact that one belligerent in Europe has captured 10,000 cannon. So, these techniques don't even change. It's 1916 and they're saying, we got to get 10,000 cannon immediately. Yes. And in fact, they did get a lot more than that. Again, this is a very complex story, but we're just going to deal with the sort of geopolitical outline of it. There were battles, but the alarming thing from the U.S. perspective is as they pushed further into Mexico, it wasn't always the Villistas they were fighting. It was official Mexican forces loyal to Carranza. And that was not officially the idea to start a war with Mexico. And by the time they were in Parral, 500 miles south of the border, still looking for Villa, who had never shown himself, who had forced the U.S. into making this a hunt for one suspect, and then started doing classic Robin Hood stunts. Like there's a legend that he was at a screening of a movie for the entertainment of U.S. troops, and he was sort of waving to Mexicans in the audience. And they all knew who he was, great. And the Americans didn't know. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's a great story.
I want to believe it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So there are battles again between Villistas, as at Guerrero, and then at Parral against Carranza, the official Mexican army. And the U.S. decides, basta, And the official quote is, it is not dignified for the United States to be hunting one man in a foreign country. April 21st, Pershing orders a withdrawal, and they slowly and grudgingly withdraw. But yeah, the George Patton story is quite a little sidelight. George Patton was just full of spunk, and as you say, he was on record as thinking, "Oh boy, a war!
Yeah, yeah. Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy! This is my chance to shine." And I'll bet you he looked at Pancho Villa and like, in jealousy, in a sense. Yeah. Not that he wanted to be that kind of famous guy, because he was more of a fancy pants.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a
You don't
Roman,
want to start out as a sharecropper.
Yeah, yeah. But but the idea of being sort of a star, like a kind of the guy that everyone talks about, it's clear that's what
he
wanted.
Well, and Pershing, Pershing in a way that might have been naive or might have been rather sardonic, nicknamed Patton the Bandito, as if he was well aware of Patton's desire to pattern himself on the supposed quarry, Villa. So his biggest exploit was that he took three touring cars and went after one of Villa's lieutenants who was holed up somewhere, and he brought back that man and two others dead strapped to the car like deer after a hunting expedition. So what that says about Patton's legacy or future behavior is probably not very encouraging. But yeah. He was at least a hard charger, and the army probably liked that. Yeah. The last battle of the campaign, which made no sense to anybody by this point, was a defeat for the U.S. Carranza's forces beat the U.S. at Carrizal. And once again, it was a battle against our supposed allies, or at any rate, the legitimate rulers of the country in the U.S.'s opinion. Villa was clearly laughing at them. There was no chance anybody was going to catch up with Villa. The peasantry kind of profited from the war, and they were selling stuff to soldiers who, to their standards, had incredible amounts of money at very high prices. But Villa,
I'm throwing a little bit of Montezuma's revenge in those tacos as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would, wouldn't I?
Yeah. You like my hot sauce.
Yeah, Villa's comment, as always, and this is one of the skills for someone like Villa. One of the skills is having a good eye for a good line, you know, for a good scene, for the whole theatrics. He said, "That Pershing came in like an eagle and leaves now like a wet chicken."
Yeah, that's a great line. I love it. I want to use that sometime. I hope I have an opportunity.
Yeah.
But it's amazing as they made their way down 500 miles, you know, deep into Mexican territory, people hated them or, you know, sold them stuff at vastly inflated prices and also sabotaged and told Villa's people or Carranza or whoever, you know, they would act as eyes and ears and keeping quiet and so on. I mean, it's so obvious. But you see, like, it's interesting that, you know, how quickly they realized, especially as this big conventional war, which is just great for everybody at the top of the ruling classes and capitalism, how great the European war was compared to this lousy little war. There's no winning it. It's grubby, it's dirty. Like even the commanders can't live in luxury. Everybody hates us. There's nothing glorious about it. And you're never going to catch this guy.
So no, and you're being laughed at.
Yeah, being laughed at. It's undignified.
No, you know? at least even if you walked into the machine guns, you know, one might laugh at them, actually. But officially, nobody laughed at you.
Yeah. Johnson, why don't you do this? Walk into that machine gun there. You'll be a hero, baby. I know. Yeah. It's but officially they didn't laugh at him, and they certainly didn't laugh. They didn't feel they were being laughed at the top.
Right.
And so you can see how, I mean, there is a parallel in a sense here, but how the war on terror, despite all of the death and misery and destruction it brought on the world, just eventually became a bummer. You know, it was a big bummer. There was no winning it. In fact, the more we fought the so-called war on terror, the more it metastasized, the very thing that was supposed to be defeated. And so eventually, I mean, the Ukraine war and the lead up to the Ukraine war kind of saved the military, which had been wanting to pivot to big conventional.
And not just the military, the mainstream media as well.
Yes, everybody.
Because they had a moment of extreme pain when Bin Laden, the Pancho Villa of his day, let's say, was discovered in a villa about, I forget what it was, like 500 meters from a Pakistani military base.
Yeah.
I mean, that was embarrassing. Yep. And at least Ukraine doesn't bring that kind of embarrassment. Or if it does, it will not be covered.
Yeah. And yeah, I think it's fair to say it doesn't. Bin Laden was no Pancho Villa, I'll say that on a lot of levels.
No sense of humor.
No sense of humor at all. No good lines like that. Leaves like a wet chicken. It's kind of it's a fairly kind of happy story in the sense that, well, Pancho Villa wasn't killed, you know, in an undignified way. He got to live out his life. I mean, he didn't.
Well, he got killed later.
Got killed later. Yes, when he ran for president. That's true.
Yeah.
But he didn't get killed by the Americans, I guess. I mean, he died. No. It was a dignified death running for president. More dignified than what the Americans would have done, I think.
In fact, there's a rumor that, not to get back into the story, it's too complicated, but the uncle of this teenager who got conscripted into his army was, he fingered Villa, supposedly.
Interesting.
For the assassination squad.
So the lesson here should be don't invade Mexico, which is exactly why the Republicans will do it. Not like the Democrats aren't capable of doing their own stupid shit, but as we know, but the Republicans will always top them. They'll always find a way to top them, or usually anyway. Yeah.
Well, the U.S. has been circling disaster for a long time, but they've managed to keep it far away, and now they're laser focused on their own border, and it's as if "bring the war home" is their slogan.
Yeah, and it's weird. It's like the politically, it has become so. Well, it's clearly failing. Just judging by polls, it's the political structure and the political elites are failing, and so it's. There's this sort of cycle whereby the more they fail, the more they want to double down on bad ideas that fail.
Yeah.
It's like they're retreating into them. So this would be really like the ultimate or one ultimate version of it. So I guess, the China war is the big baby that they all want to do. It's like that's the one thing they all agree on. That's where they all want to die and drag us down with them. But But anyway, it's a great story.
It's a story that will be ignored. That's kind of a shame because it is a great story. It's really odd. I was thinking about this when I was researching the story. It's why haven't there been more movies about this?
I know. Every time, like each of those raids, including the raid into the U.S., Bavia's raid, it's so... I can see the spaghetti Western, but for reals, for very reals, with much higher stakes.
Yep.
And it's so damn cinematic. Well, he did have, for a while, he had some Hollywood people. He allowed them to film him. And then they shared the revenues and whatever was shown. That was when he was really big. So they knew at the time that he was cinematic, but I guess once you kill some Americans,
it's very odd. I mean,
we're 100 years later. Like, why should we care?
I mean, Hollywood is supposedly searching avidly for Latino or Latina heroes, and this guy seems pretty much made to order.
I don't know if they are, which is something I always find weird considering, the proportion of the population Latinos. I don't, they seem to get proportionally ignored in culture,
that's true.
In popular that culture. True. That may come at some point, but up to now, it's kind of strange we don't talk about it that much. But I think the Hollywood people, they've opened up lately to more films about African Americans, but not Latinos so much.
No, that's oddly true, in fact.
Yeah. Huh. So. I think it's a different kind of guilt, which they fear would turn off viewers. It's a different guilt than the historical guilt of slavery. It's a very current, present guilt.
Very of course, it doesn't have to be guilt. You don't have to do this story as a guilt story.
I just think seeing Latinos on the screen for white people is all I mean. Latino heroes, Anyway. Highly recommend anybody out there who's in the movie making business, do the damn Pancho Villa movie. It's amazing. All right. Well, I think on that note we can wrap up, John.
All right.
Hope you feel better. You are
getting a shot in a couple of days.
Good.
I feel like a vampire, on a blind date schedule. It's like, oh boy.
Well, you sound better than even a few days ago, so it does seem to be working. I hope you're feeling better, too.
All right. Thanks. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.